all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Bob Gould.
And welcome once again to Veterans Radio right here in the Garden Spot of the Midwest, the Garden Spot of Michigan, good old Ann Arbor, in WAAM, the studios right here on Packard Road. And with me right now is my partner. He's looking great today, folks. I mean, you ought to see this guy, huh? He looks like Ernest Hemingway, short beard and all that, got a little tan, and things must be really good. Dale Thronberry. Dale, welcome.
Thank you very much, Bob. It is a pleasure to be here. I think that this is a very important day. We're going to talk about a lot
of
things. I know you got. We got all kinds of news. But I want to jump in here with something just right away. September is National Suicide Prevention Month, and I want to remind people here, especially in the Ann Arbor local area, if they would head out to Huron River Drive, out off of Whitaker Road, and check out the Veterans Refuge display of 660 crosses. And what those 660 crosses represent are 22 veterans who are committing suicide every day. And I'm not trying to start this off on a low note, but it's something that's really, really important. As I was leaving this to come over to the studio today, the New York Times has a front page story of a Marine battalion that has lost 22 young men
to suicide.
And next week, I'm going to scrap whatever I've got scheduled for next week, and we're going to do a program on suicide prevention, because this is just getting to be intolerable that we can allow this to happen. The Veterans Administration, and I don't normally slam them, but they're not doing their job as far as mental health is concerned. It's very difficult for people to get in there for therapy. It's very difficult for them to see a therapist more than sometimes once a month. And when you're in serious situations, you have to see somebody more. So there's a lot of organizations out there that are starting up their own support groups.
It like who?
Well, actually, the local VVA chapter is setting up a support group. We're just getting it started, and there's a couple of people in there, and we are just talking about things.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really all you need. And you mentioned this the other day. And in fact, one of the people that I saw the other day at our support group was talking about the idea of dropping disorder from post-traumatic stress.
And we are going to start that, folks, starting today. Drop the D. That's it. T-shirts, everything are coming out. Drop the D. I was talking to a soldier 2 weeks ago, and he said to me, I have PTS. Oh, you do? What about the D? He said, I don't have a disorder. I have stress. That's it. I mean, do they say that about an accountant when they're all burned out? Well, he's got PTS. No, they only say that on veterans.
Well, it's not just veterans. It's anybody who's had some sort of traumatic event occur in their lives. And the thing is that the disorder, as they call it, is coming from the outside, not from the inside.
Exactly.
So it's not a disease.
Exactly.
It's people that need help in figuring out how they can muster the strength to get beyond whatever their traumatic experience was, or whatever it was that happened to them. So I agree. Well, let's get rid of the D. I think that's an excellent idea, and I think next week we're going to try and really concentrate on that subject. It's just so important. I was so disturbed this morning in reading the New York Times front page. So if anybody out there, even if you don't read the Times, go to it online and just look at the front page. It's about a Marine battalion that has set up their own support group because they can't get the help that they need.
Something along the same line that you were talking about as far as support group is something called Buddy to Buddy.
Buddy to Buddy, right. It's almost a mentoring system.
I love it.
That's
we're taking care of each other, folks. Got it?
That's the point, is that we've always been taught to, we have your back there, we've got your back here. And this has kind of been a mantra of Veterans Radio and, of course, veterans organizations around the country, is we're just going to make sure that you don't fall through the cracks. We want to make sure that you get the help that you need. We want to make sure that there are people that you can talk to. And if you can't get into somebody right away, we've got, there are emergency lines that you can call if you are contemplating doing any harm to yourself or anybody else. Just don't do it. Call. It's not a bad thing to ask for help. Every once in a while, we all need it. And I think that it's so important that we are there to help you out. We are there to get you through this period in your life, and hopefully we can get you back to where you were and you can continue on. Because you've got wives, you've got kids, you've got families, and if you commit suicide, all of them are going to be just as traumatized. anyway, that's my editorial for the day.
Sounds
but next week, is what we're going
to
be doing. So make sure you tune into Veterans Radio next week.
And remember, drop the D. PTS. Got it? Post-traumatic. In fact, I don't even like post-traumatic. I'd like to think of event stress, but we'll take it one step. And I wonder whoever did that way back. You know, it's usually it's not the medical people. It's not the
it's been around for years and years and years.
I mean the whole idea that it's a disorder. That's my point.
Well, yeah, everybody has to deal with stuff.
Okay, one thing that all you're right. going to need if you're going to and we're going to keep doing this every week. We're going to talk about DD214. Hey man, what about that? Well, your DD214, it's everything you need. Everything, one page, that's it. DD, you know what it is. If you don't have it, here's how you get it. Got yourself a pencil, paper, whatever. National Personal Records Center. Number one, Archives Drive. St. Louis, Mo. 63138-1002. That's National Personal Records Center. One, Archives Drive. St. Louis, Missouri, 63138-1002. Or go to archives.gov, and you can get your DD24. That's you got to have that, Dale.
That's your ticket into the whole into the system. The other thing is that if you have a relative who has passed away and may have been entitled to some benefits, as the living relative, you can contact that organization and get the copy of the DD214. For your relative, not, you know, like they talk about this fire, and it wasn't that many that were destroyed during that fire in St. Louis back in the early 60s. I think it was somewhere
74.
Check with your local veteran service officer too. If everything that Bob was talking about confuses you, contact your local VSO, American Legion, VBA, BFW, AMVETS. If you live in Michigan, there are county VSO offices, and they'll get this stuff for you.
Wow, that is exciting. You know, and I was talking to someone the other day who his dad was Air Force and has passed, and I asked him, I said, have you looked into your benefits? What benefits do I get? Well, you do get some benefits. You need to know what they are. So here's what you can do. The 6th Annual Veterans Summit.
Oh, that one.
Saturday, October 3rd. Dale's getting out his notes right there. At the Vista Tech Center. Vista Tech Center starts at 8 o'clock. They're even going to feed you lunch, folks. Barbecue. Ooh, sounds good. And that is the Veterans Summit, 6th Annual Veterans Summit at Schoolcraft College, Saturday, October 3rd, from 8 o'clock to 2:30. You've got to register first. They got to know how much barbecue to have, right? Right. So, Dale, what do you know about all
moving
that?
Moving right along. Well, I know.
No, I'm getting this thing.
You got
here.
More stuff? I got it. I got it right here. You need to contact the CantonFoundation.org. Mm-hmm. You can registration on their website, or you can contact Beth Mead at 734-495-1200. 734-495-1200. Her name is Beth Mead, or you can get register at the CantonFoundation.org. They're the sponsors of this Veterans Summit. It is Saturday, October 3rd. As Bob mentioned, the Vista Tech Center at Schoolcraft College on Haggerty Road. You shouldn't have any problem. Just throw that into your GPS, and you'll be able to find the building. It's a really gorgeous building.
Don't come there right at 8, okay, folks?
Reveille
7 o'clock.
I think they probably have coffee and things like that. It is sponsored by the DeWitt Holberg Charitable Trust and our good friends at Legal Help for Veterans. So we encourage you to go there. It's free for veterans of all ages and their families. Bob was mentioning the DD-214, and I think that these people might be helping. Maybe Grandpa died, unfortunately, but maybe he's entitled to some medals. And wouldn't it be great for the grandchildren or you to know what Grandpa did during the war? I mean, we did a program on that last week. What did Grandpa do during World War II? Well, some of these people are entitled to medals that they never got. And this is your opportunity to put together that life chest, which we'll talk about in another program, where you can put together a little display of your family history, and I think that's important.
And you can get all of the awards and medals that were awarded to.
And they'll send them to you free.
And they will send them to you, absolutely. So starts with the DD-214, and then I think all the information is right there on that record center. So then we've got the summit coming up.
I got a dinner. This is the one that you wanted me to talk to you about.
Oh, wait, I have one more, and then talk about yours, okay?
No, I know. Me first. Okay,
no. Arm wrestle. Here we go, folks. It's Thursday, October 8th, 12 o'clock noon. A salute to Vietnam-era veterans in Lansing, Michigan, 12 o'clock noon. It's at the Michigan State Capitol. It's going to have to RSVP. It's called Michigan MichiganSaysThanks.com. MichiganSaysThanks.com. That's where you RSVP. Those of you that don't know what that is, recevez-vous plat. That means
let me know if they're coming or going.
And let them know how many, too. Thursday, October 8th, 12 noon, Michigan State Capitol is going to be there. There's going to be music tents, speakers, all kinds of displays, everything. Dale.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, go to Lansing on the 8th. While you're there, maybe you can tell the legislators to fix our roads. a little political comment here.
We don't do those.
All right, coming up on Thursday, September 24th, this coming Thursday, there's a steak dinner fundraiser for the American Indian Veterans of Michigan. This is Veterans for Veterans. This is going to be at 5 o'clock. Admissions is $15, and it is going to be held at the Southeastern Michigan Indians, Inc. In Centerline, Michigan. For more information, you need to contact Chris Franklin. That's Chris Franklin at 248-210-6153, 248-210-6153. And this is the American Indian Veterans of Michigan, Incorporated. That is also their website, $15, Veterans for Veterans, another way for veterans helping each other.
And where's that going to be held? In Centerline?
Centerline at the, it's on Lawrence. I'm not familiar. Oh, it says south of 11 Mile, west of Van Dyke.
Ooh, that's out there. That's really out there.
Yeah.
That's in the boonies, man.
But there's a VetFest going on today, actually, while we're speaking, that is being held out there also. And you have to go to on your internet and look for a VetFest. It's up in Macomb County. I'll try and find it while you talk about whatever you're going to talk about.
You know, it's really cool, folks, that we have this opportunity. We actually talk to the world. We were broadcast all over the world on our web. And let us know when you have an event coming up, something. There's nothing too small, right, Dale?
Absolutely. Speaking of one, I got more.
He's got more, folks.
The Veteran Artist Program.
Oh, yeah.
And this is a program that is designed to help artists and that are veterans to display their works. They have shows coming up. In fact, there's a major show coming
there's
up.
There's no Velvet Elvis, right?
No, I don't think there's any Velvet Elvis, but there is going to be a show at the Lincoln Center in New York City on November 12th. And this is something that you may want to check out. It's VAP, veteranartistprogram.org. It's going to be the home show, and it's featuring an all-star lineup of all kinds of different people, and it's going to be at the Lincoln Center on November 12th, 2015. For more information, you need to go to their website. I think it's next week. Oh, not next week, maybe. But we're going to be having somebody else on the program to talk about another one of their regional programs that they're going to be having in Connecticut. Coming up in November also. So stay tuned. There's a lot of great things. This is Veterans Helping Veterans.
Veterans Helping Veterans. Forget
this is what we do,
other
Ben.
Folks.
We take care of our own if we need to.
We're watching your back, and you can use us as your sounding board. You can use us to communicate the information. Well, we're going to be right back with, September Hope. There were things going on, World War II, 71 years ago. September Hope. I'll be right back in just a few moments with our guests, John McManus and Kevin Hemel. Don't go away. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
I wrote my mother. I wrote my father. And now I'm writing you too. I'm sure of mother.
Veterans Radio with my partner Dale Thornberry. I'm Bob Gould. We're broadcasting again from our flagship studios in Ann Arbor, Michigan, WAAM. Well, okay. This is still World War II. We've got with us on the line two authors who've been frequent guests on Veterans Radio. My first one I want to introduce is our guest author for today is John McManus. He's professor of military history at Missouri University of Science and Technology. Professor McManus has written numerous books on World War II, and he serves as a member of the editorial board of World War II magazine. Oh, I got to subscribe to that. I'll have to talk to John about that. In researching his book, September Hope, he traveled all around, did lots of interviews, and he's been here to tell us all about September Hope Market Garden. And with him is Kevin Hemel, historian for the U.S. Combat Studies Institute. Kevin has also wrote military history narratives on Afghanistan. He's also the author of Patton's Photographs and Patton, Legendary World War II Commander. By the way, we got a lot of emails on that particular book, folks that have picked that up. And don't forget, folks, it's coming up, Christmas time and all the holidays, so you're going to want to pay close attention. Professor Hemel has appeared on the History Channel, the Military Channel, Fox News, Book TV, and he's also speaking about Patton military history. He's worked for over 20 years on military history magazines. Presently, he's working on a book focusing exclusively on General Patton's experience during World War II, titled Patton's War. Kevin holds a master's degree in American history from Villanova University. Gentlemen, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hey, great to be here, Bob.
How are you, Bob?
Okay, well, let's make sure. Oh, we got that. There we go. We're working out of a new studio today, so things get a little hairy. All right, here it is. I want to ask the question. We're jubilant. It's now after D-Day. It's August 1944. Everybody is looking. We are just smashing. We're smashing through the German armies. We're pushing on. The Russians are coming from the east. The Americans are now coming from the west. There's no stopping them. And, you know, I heard something the other day on a movie about tanks called Fury. They asked a question, why didn't they give up? Why don't they quit? John, tell us about that.
Well, the unconditional surrender policy that the Allies had implemented a couple of years before, it's certainly a factor in German resistance. I mean, the Nazi regime knows that there's not going to be any kind of negotiated settlement, or it's at least highly unlikely unless you have political change.
Is that what they wanted?
Well, of course, Hitler being Hitler, he's kind of an annihilationist anyway, and I don't think Hitler envisions any kind of post-war German world without him being a part of it. So he's already inclined to fight to the death, and of course he's a very charismatic and effective leader who has millions of Germans who have seen it much the same way. And so
at that
time, the other factor too, even if you're not a fanatical Nazi, the Allies are approaching your home soil, and you know you're likely to fight for your home soil and your family a lot more than you would conquer territory somewhere else. So German resistance, though, by the latter summer of 1944, in the wake of their disaster in Normandy and also on the Eastern Front, is certainly collapsing. And so this operation, you know, to go through Holland and into Germany and onto Berlin that we call Market Garden is sort of born out of that hope or that optimism that maybe German resistance will somehow collapse.
Well, there are attempts on Hitler's life, so he doesn't have the support of his military, and they're looking for ways to where does he get his support from?
His support, really, much of it comes from the average German soldier who sees him as a charismatic, unique, great German nationalist. And if there's anyone who can figure a way out of this mess Germany's gotten into by the fall of 1944, it's the Führer, at least in the view of many average Germans and average German soldiers. Certainly, Hitler by then had burned a lot of bridges with the German high command, and obviously, as you'd mentioned, you know, some of them had attempted to assassinate him in July 1944 unsuccessfully, and there had been a great deal of tension with the German generals before that. But you also had, I should point out, certainly plenty of SS-oriented generals and Nazified generals as well who were ready to follow Hitler, on into oblivion. So it's a bit of a mixed bag, but he still has, in terms of, you know, if we're looking at his overall support, he still has enough support for Germany to continue fighting on. And so... that's the bad news from an Allied perspective.
Okay. They're going to try a left hook. They're going to try a left hook, very famous in boxing, coming out of nowhere. They're going to do Market Garden. That's being set up by Montgomery. Kevin, tell us, what did Patton think about all that?
Patton thought it was an attack in the wrong direction. he had been basically flying across France from August 1st on. Instead of attacking the enemy, he was going around the enemy, encircling the enemy. That's going to result in the Great Filet Pocket. And he's just making incredible progress, just like he did in Sicily, where Montgomery was stalled. Patton was maneuvering and attacking and succeeding. And he's basically repeating that same action, surrounding the enemy, causing a panic, causing a huge retreat, driving to the border. And as he, as his forces close in on the German border in early September, you know, he's basically got the, it looks like to him he's got the road open to him. And if the Allies are limited in fuel and ammunition, it should be going to him. Reinforce my success. I'm accomplishing this. I'm making it happen. Just get me to the Rhine River. You know, Patton was desperate to continue pushing forward. You know, he said, my men can eat their belts, but my tanks need gas. He had really proven that it could be done, but, it, you know, to Eisenhower, Montgomery had more vital targets in front of him that needed to be attacked, but to Patton, they were going in the wrong, they were winning the war in the wrong direction.
And so he wanted to get all the provisions, get everything started. He wanted, I mean, was this more of an ego thing, or was it really true?
I guess you'd have to say with anything with Patton, it was an ego thing. You know, there simply wasn't enough fuel to go around. I think that's why the Market Garden was such an appealing idea to Eisenhower, because three of the divisions would not need to be fueled, the three airborne divisions, where Patton, you know, he was using armored divisions with infantry divisions that also used fuel and food and ammunition. And it, there just wasn't enough getting to the front for anybody. But, of course, Patton being Patton takes it personally. He's not getting the supplies. He's not getting the attention. He's not getting the direction that he feels he should get from Eisenhower to let him do what he wants to do to the enemy.
Okay, John. So how does Montgomery win the moment?
Yeah, what's interesting to consider here is that, you know, Eisenhower, you know, of course, has two famously contentious subordinates, Montgomery and Patton, ironically kind of see the solution to Germany's demise the same way. Both of them want a single thrust into Germany, but, of course, exclusively under their command with almost all the resources earmarked to them. Montgomery sees that as, of course, the airborne operation of Market Garden and an armored thrust into northern Germany, and with the idea being to get to Berlin and outflank the industrial Ruhr and the Siegfried line, a belt of western fortifications that Patton would have to come up against, where he's sort of hitting close to the gut around Metz and places like that. Patton, of course, wants the full priority for him, as Kevin mentioned, this thrust into the gut of Germany to outflank the Ruhr and the West Wall from the other direction. But Eisenhower really wants a broad front, which I think is a very kind of American solution to this. Why put all resources into one thrust, one or the other? Why not overwhelm them with a complete and total shoulder-to-shoulder advance and use all your advantages of mobility, logistics, material, manpower, firepower, and the like? And so, you know, in studying the whole Market Garden thing, it's kind of stunning that Montgomery persuades Eisenhower in a fateful meeting aboard a plane on the tarmac at the Brussels airport on September 10, 1944, to adopt this kind of bold gamble of an airborne drop behind the lines and a quick operation to seize key bridges over the major river systems, including the Rhine, of course. And Eisenhower, sees it at that point as, it's nice to have that bridgehead and then I can just do whatever from there. He doesn't see it as, I'm deciding on this single thrust, which isn't what I had wanted. And once Market Garden comes to fruition, he realizes far too late that everything is now heading in that direction, and he has bet way too much on what was a really risky operation.
Well, Eisenhower was always known as a compromising person, so what was the compromise here?
The compromise here is that he's able to afford priority for the moment to Montgomery and his operation, and he's able to bring into bear three of his elite units that had not really been in combat for a while, the airborne divisions that were languishing in England waiting for a mission. And a lot of expenses and a lot of training and a lot of good cream of your manpower had been invested in these units. So, you know, Eisenhower wanted them in action. So he sees Market Garden as a kind of imminent compromise, give Montgomery something of what he wants, get these bridgeheads across the Rhine, and then he can exploit them later. And, of course, what quickly happens is that Market Garden, being what it is, it sucks up the remaining logistics he's got. And I'll give you one very quick example that happens at Omar Bradley's expense. There were several newly arrived American divisions that had just arrived in Normandy and are waiting to deploy to the front. Well, they get stripped of all their trucking because it's so badly needed for Market Garden, and these divisions are immobilized for much of about 6 weeks, just languishing and waiting, all of which were about to be added to Bradley's armies. And so Omar Bradley was an even bigger opponent of Market Garden than George Patton, if that's even possible.
Okay, we're talking about supplies. What was the failure to take Antwerp? Why don't you tell us about that?
Right.
You want me to talk about that?
Oh, I'm sorry, John. John.
Maybe both of us, but go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'll just chime in real first. Antwerp is a city in Belgium, and so it's deeper into Europe where so many supplies are coming from the far west across the English Channel into Normandy onto the beaches and then rolled forward, whereas Antwerp is a large modern port city that can handle a lot of supplies. And although the Canadian Army captures it, it's at the end of a very long river, estuary, as they call it. And so even though it's captured, the Germans control the banks of the river leading to it, so it's almost irrelevant. And this is something that Montgomery was supposed to do as an early objective, and it's just not doing it. Once Antwerp can be used as a port, it's going to cause a huge relief of all of these supply problems. And so Montgomery ignores it to the Allies' detriment, and it's got Patton, you know, pulling out whatever hair he's got, and same with Omar Bradley. John?
Right. Antwerp, you know, is such a massive and major port complex, really the greatest in all of northern Europe, that it's capable of feeding about half of Eisenhower's armies. And then in tandem with Marseille in south France, you have the two of them plus all the others, you're going to be okay. So Antwerp really should be, in my view, the key objective for the Allies in late August, early September. And instead, here's what happens. The British armies get it on September 4th, capture the docks intact, all this. Just a great coup de main. But as Kevin correctly mentioned, Antwerp's an inland port. And so the Scheldt estuary runs for about 60 miles. So unless you control those waterways and all those little islands and clear them of mines, you're not going to be able to use Antwerp. So Market Garden, Eisenhower, in giving the go-ahead for Market Garden, takes his eye off the ball in terms of making sure to control that estuary and make sure that Antwerp is in operation, which would have solved all of his logistical problems, mostly. And so Market Garden really costs you Antwerp for many months because the Germans take advantage of this respite that they get, and they heavily fortify the Scheldt estuary. And so later that fall, it's the Canadians, especially, but some Americans in October and November who get the terrible job of clearing it out. And, of course, by then, Market Garden has failed, so it's a double whammy. And not until December 15th are the Allies able to really begin making use of Antwerp. So they've failed on a lot of levels, and it's why in my book, September Hope, I afford ultimate responsibility to Market Garden and its failure to Eisenhower. He's the one who gives the go-ahead and kind of takes his eye away from clearing Antwerp and making sure that's in operation.
Well, we've got about a minute before the break. How many total Allies and U.S. Troops were at Market Garden? John?
There were two U.S. airborne divisions, the 82nd and the 101st. And by the time Market Garden is finished, almost all those divisions are in play. So you're talking about, some 35,000 American soldiers, plus the aviators and plus some support units that do come in later on once you have a corridor. So it's primarily a British operation, as I think most everybody knows from that standpoint, but
okay.
A significant American.
All right. We have to get right up to the break. You're listening to Veterans Radio right here on WAAM Talk 1600.
If you ever go down Trinidad, they make you feel so very glad. Calypso sing and make up rhyme, guarantee you one real good fine time. Drinking rum and Coca-Cola. Go down Point Cumana, both mother and daughter, working for the Yankee dollar.
Oh, beat it, mommy, beat it.
Since the Yankee come to Trinidad, they got the young girls all going mad. Young girls say they treat them nice, make Trinidad like paradise. Drinking rum and Coca-Cola, go down Point Cumana.
And you're back right now on Veterans Radio, and I have with me Kevin Hemel and John McManus, both authors, historians. We're talking about late 1944 World War II and Market Garden in specific. Okay, Market Garden. The the purpose of the, well, we talked about the purpose of the operation, and what about the American airborne experience? And you know, when you parachute, well, to me, this reminded me of like the blitzkrieg that Germany did. They came in with armor, and then they came in with the troops. Well, that's kind of like the way Market Garden was, right, guys? You had armor was coming up, but you did have some troops that had to hold the bridges, but here come the army. It was just like the German blitzkrieg. Is that correct, Kevin?
I would say it's even more than that, because the Allies had so much more equipment, and especially for the Americans, men at this point, that it's sort of like a German blitzkrieg on steroids. Now, the problem or the challenge you have with the British fighting in Holland is you have these narrow raised roads, and it's only one road that's leading north to these bridges. So if the Germans can continually cut this road, then they can take the initiative, and that's exactly what happens. But the American and British airborne is so much stronger and better thought out and planned than the German airborne operations ever were. The Germans would parachute in, and they would have canisters with their rifles in it, whereas the British and the Americans would land fully armed, so they didn't have to run to anything to arm themselves. And the American, for the drop, when you compare it to Normandy, was so much more successful. You know, the few clouds in the sky, a daylight drop. You know, so many planes were dropping their soldiers too low, too high, too fast. So many injuries just getting to the ground in Normandy, where, you know, here they're jumping on freshly plowed fields. I talked to a number of veterans that told me it was their best landing all through training and in combat, that they came down in these plowed Dutch fields and how pleasant it was. And, you know, and it's a different nature of fighting, too. And, John, I wonder if you could speak to this, because a lot of the cities that the Americans had reached in World War II up to this point in Europe, they were hollowed out shells of cities because they had just been bombed so heavily, because every town and every city is a crossroad. So the Allied air forces are bombing these long before the American troops get there. Whereas in Holland, these are intact modern cities they're fighting through, as opposed to sort of the bombed out shells they've reached before. And so you're seeing a lot of fighting on modern bridges and in modern towns. So it's a lot of it's sort of akin to some of the fighting you see today in modern areas. It's very sort of up to date instead of that sort of step back to World War One trench warfare.
Yeah, and those, you know, that corridor where this battle is going to be fought, say from Grave all the way up to Arnhem. You know, you look at the bridges over the major river systems, the Maas, and of course the Rhine, the Waal. I mean, these were some of, in fact, they were the most modern bridges in all of Europe. You know, and there, you know, you're talking nine, you know, spans to these bridges, and you know, modern engineering, and only a few years old. You know, the other thing too, the terrain. If you go and you look at that terrain around those towns where the drop zones were, if you could have imagined, you know, as a sort of paratrooper commander or a glider commander, you know, what would be our perfect drop zones? What would be the perfect terrain? If you look at these areas in Holland, they're just flat as a pancake. And
that's
it's
right.
Perfect to you know, to land troops. Of course, you're also vulnerable in a daylight drop, as they were, but this is part of the surprise element of it, that the Germans were not really prepared for something like this. And you were landing so many troops, there's 25,000 plus on the first day alone. There's no way, of course, the enemy could be everywhere. So the other interesting wrinkle to this, from an armor commander's point of view, as great as modern as the battlefield is and as great as the infrastructure, the road net is surprisingly narrow and inadequate to move so many vehicles. And this is one of the flaws of Market Garden, that most of the vehicles devolve onto this one narrow corridor the Americans would come to call Hell's Highway, that makes them, of course, very, very vulnerable as the operation unfolds.
John, tell us about the Dutch experience.
The Dutch experience, I think, in this whole thing is fascinating because, of course, Holland had been under an unhappy occupation for four some odd years. Now, I should qualify that statement by saying, you know, some Dutch had cast their lot with the Nazis. You know, the Dutch were seen by the Nazis as racial equals, and so some had been, of course, recruited into the Dutch equivalent of the SS, if not the SS or the German army. There was that, but the majority, of course, were fed up with the Germans and wanted them out, and the Dutch resistance was a very well-organized, very well-armed, very formidable operation by 1944, as was the Dutch army in exile. So they're going to work with Allied commanders. General Gavin, the 82nd Airborne Division commander, had a Dutch army captain with his command group. And the Dutch resistance groups, once Market Garden happens, they're going to want to be part of the battle. And they will in many instances and suffer significant casualties. And the other thing to remember, a lot of them represented different political factions in Holland and didn't necessarily agree with each other. So sometimes they were bickering with one another as well as against the Germans. The civilians, the everyday folks, are absolutely thrilled to see the Americans and the British, especially the Americans. If you ask most any veteran, and Kevin might vouch for this too, because this is the experience I had speaking with many veterans, this was the place they enjoyed fighting the most in World War II, because they felt the country was so pro-American, so clean, so much that they could relate to it, and the people welcomed them as friends. And I think it's fair to say there's still a very strong bond of friendship between the Dutch and the Americans that exists to this day. When you go there as an American and visit some of these places, you're likely to get a very nice greeting. So the Dutch are major players in Market Garden all the way throughout, and of course, when it fails, they're the ones who pay the price as much as anybody.
Kevin, tell us about General Gavin.
Well, he was an airborne commander, and he was sort of the one of the tip-of-the-spear kind of soldiers, I guess you would say. He was a battalion commander. Regimental commander, and his regiment was one of the first airborne regiments, the 505th. In fact, when they created the 82nd Airborne Division, he said, well, it's nice that they attach this division to my regiment, you know, that kind of point of pride. But, you know, he jumped always out of the plane first. He performed magnificently in Sicily, did well in Italy. He was promoted to the assistant division commander and spent a lot of time planning the invasion of D-Day. And then when General Ridgway, the division commander, was promoted to corps command, the obvious choice was James Gavin. And I have never heard a bad word about him from a veteran. They just had immense respect for him. He would, you know, always in the front lines, walking, exposing himself to fire, you know, nerves of steel, and just the kind of soldier you want leading men in combat. I'll add real quickly to what John was saying about the civilians. There was that contingent of collaborators, and one time when I was in Holland, I asked a local historian, I said, exactly how many collaborators were there in Holland? And he said, too many. That was kind of the perfect answer, probably like one is too many. And John was talking about the relationship between the Dutch and the Americans. This whole week being the anniversary of Market Garden, I have just been getting lots of emails and Facebook messages from all my friends in Holland. There are parades going on. There are ceremonies going on. The Dutch, it's like nothing I've ever seen before. All the Allied countries that we liberated, they have their place of respect for the Americans. But the Dutch, it's 100%. And they even have a ceremony every year at the Margraten. They have an American cemetery there of American fallen. And locals adopt a grave and will research the person and contact their family and their descendants. And they will keep that grave looking excellent. And once a year, they have a big ceremony at the cemetery. It's a great feeling as an American to visit these areas.
Do you happen to have that website, Kevin?
I do not.
Okay.
Which website?
The one that that they can find out about the graves.
www.abmc.com. It's the American Battle Monuments Commission. And, you know, you can look up the various cemeteries. You can look up individuals. It won't necessarily put you in touch with Dutch families, although, you know, that could come from it if you get deep into it. But that'll at least give you the basic information about where the cemeteries are, who's there, so on and so forth.
Yep.
Now, John, a lot of us have seen the movie A Bridge Too Far. And one of the points that was brought out, that unbeknownst, and you can comment on the intelligence, unbeknownst was a entire Panzer army. Was R&R, retro and refitting, and the Americans or allies didn't know it. Did they or did they not, John?
They actually did, and it was actually a Panzer Corps. It was two depleted Panzer divisions, which were still quite formidable, the 9th and 10th SS Panzer. And the Allied photo intelligence what was called the First Airborne Corps, which was, you know, the airborne component of this operation under General Boy Browning, the British commander, had seen some photo intelligence that revealed, armored vehicles that were probably tanks at or near some of the British landing zones in the environs of Arnhem, which is, of course, the famous Bridge Too Far, where that was located. So there is a sense, and it goes all the way up to Montgomery, yes, there's more German military there than we thought. There are some issues. But in the end, Montgomery and certainly Browning dismissed this and say, we have to proceed regardless. And, of course, this is, in the end, a, tragic decision.
I want to get right now to talking about what were the results. We've only got a couple of minutes for this particular break coming up. What were the results of the failure of Margaret Garden, Kevin?
You've got an entire Allied army stationary on a line with the Germans that is not breaking through, and you're burning up your elite troops, putting them in regular infantry positions. You know what? In one word, I can tell you the situation. Stalemate. Neither side has a great tactical advantage by the end. They are frozen in place, and they're going to remain that way for a number of months, long after the Battle of the Bulge. The one word I would use to describe it is stalemate.
John, we've got about 30 seconds before the break. Tell us, I know it's tough, but the failure of Market Garden, real quick.
Right, the failure of Market Garden means that you're not going to be able to use Antwerp. And I think that means you're going to fight for the rest of the winter of 44 and 45, and it also... And we can talk about this maybe on the other side of the break. Market Garden really helps directly lead to the Bulge because it informs Hitler's ideas and his opinions about what the Germans should do next.
Folks, we'll be right back. You're listening to Veterans Radio right here on Talk 1600 WAAM in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Chicago way. He had a boogie style that no one else could play. He was the top man at his craft. But then his number came up and he was gone with the draft. He's in the army now, a blowing reveille. He's the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. They made him blow a bugle for his Uncle Sam. It really brought him down because he couldn't jam. The captain seemed to understand. Because the next day the cap went out and drafted a band. And now the company jumps when he plays reveille. He's the boogie woogie bugle boy of Company B. A toot, a toot, a toot, a toot, a toot, he blows it into the bar. In boogie rhythm, you can't blow a note unless the bass and guitar is playing with him.
Well, welcome back to Veterans Radio. Bob Gould right here talking about Market Garden. In the fall, 1944, it was 71 years ago. And I do want to talk about the book, September Hope, that was written by John C. McManus. And it's the experience, it's the American side of A Bridge Too Far. Was there anything else that you wanted to cover on that, Kevin, on the failure?
I had mentioned the thing about these elite troops, the airborne troops, being put in just regular infantry positions, and their numbers get whittled down here. And so it's kind of a waste of an interesting asset and an important tool. And in this sort of stalemated fighting, there are some actions. I wanted to mention Easy Company in particular of the 506th Parachute Infantry Regiment of the 101st Airborne Division. This is the well-known band of brothers. And I interviewed one of the soldiers from that group. His name was Ed Mauser, and he told me about a soldier that was, you know, talking big about how he was going to kill all the Germans and eventually broke down in his foxhole and they had to get him out of there. So that sort of long drawn out battle really has its takes a toll on the troops. But there is one maneuver that is actually very well highlighted in Stephen Ambrose's book and in the miniseries Band of Brothers, and that is something called the Crossroads, where Captain Dick Winters leads a charge, even though he's outnumbered against the entire company of Germans. And basically, he was on the low ground. In a ditch, and the Germans were on the other side of a dike. And so just as the sun came up, he yells charge, and him and about, I would say, probably about 35 soldiers basically run about 500 yards in open country up to this dike and then open fire on this German company. And as this occurs, another German company comes over across dike, and it's just a slaughter. It kind of turns into a big artillery duel between the Americans and the Germans, but it's a very impressive single maneuver. And I was there recently. I took a tour group there, and the way we conclude the talk about the battle is we run the 500 yards. Any volunteers that want to do it to get the real experience. So it's a
500 yards.
Yeah, it is taxing on the legs. Let me tell you something about that. But it is a great experience if you want to sort of get the feel of what it was like to be in that battle.
John, anything else on the conclusion of Market Garden?
Can I add something to that? And I of course, have no wish to disparage the famous Easy Company. But if you want a small unit operation, has a great deal more significance to the outcome of Market Garden and was a great deal costlier and more daring. It's the wall crossing, which is portrayed in the famous movie A Bridge Too Far with Robert Redford, on the,
right.
the rowboats. The 504th Parachute Infantry, basically at that point, has secured portions of Nijmegen, but they have to get 10 miles away to Arnhem to save the British airborne. So General Gavin decides to kind of gamble and put these guys in 30 rickety canvas boats, paddle them across this major river, and you're talking a river about 100 yards wide, in broad daylight, straight at the Germans in order to secure that bank of the river and then two of the key bridges that you have to have for the armor.
Didn't they?
And
go ahead.
They're able to do this with probably about a 50 to 60% casualty rate and take those bridges, and, of course, then they thought there would be waves of British tanks that would then follow on and move on to Arnhem, but the British didn't have much to move on with. So it leads to a legacy of bitterness between the U.S. Airborne and the British armor that I think it's fair to say exists to this day.
Now, on that famous crossing that was Robert Redford in that movie, wasn't it true that they didn't have enough paddles and they had to use their rifles?
Right. They used the butts of their rifles. Exactly correct.
Yeah. That's impossible.
And of course, as this thing went on, many of the boats were destroyed or riven with holes, and so you ended up with engineers trying to recover them. And, you know, so you're down to about 10, 11, 12 boats in order to reinforce these guys on the other side of the river. It's quite a daring operation and very costly. The commander who Robert Redford portrayed, Major Julian Cook, was really quite bitter about it the rest of his life, that bitter that his troops had been put in this position and he lost so many. And he kind of blamed General Gavin for that, believe it or not. But he blamed the British as much as anything. And I think somewhat unfairly, but there was this sense that they hadn't done enough to get to Arnhem to save the British paratroopers, and that's still a point of controversy about Market Garden today.
Folks, that's it. That's Market Garden. That's not the end of the program, but that's Market Garden. Right now, we're going to talk with both of these authors because they've spent so much time, so many years doing research on their books that they've written. I want them to talk a little bit about their books. Don't forget, the holidays are coming. We're not too many weeks away, right? Months, 2 months from the holidays, and you want, hey, what should I get for the husband or the dad or the grandpa or what? How about a book? It keeps giving over and over. Perfume, cologne, you run out, but books stay. One of my favorite books that I like to look at and a friend of mine bought was The Photographic History. Oh, why don't you tell us about that, Kevin?
Oh, Patent Photographs?
Yeah.
I'd be honored to talk about that. This is a book that I published in 2006. Basically, I found the photograph that General Patton took during World War II that filled 11 photo albums, and it provided a lot more information that he personally put into these albums that really did not exist in any location before. And so I selected what I thought were the best and put it together. And so it basically covers him from when he steps on the beach in North Africa in Operation Torch in 1942 all the way to the last day of the war in 1945. And, historians are always trying to get into the heads of their subjects and figure out what they're thinking and doing. And here I had right in front of me what General Patton was looking at and what he thought was important enough to click a photograph on. So,
you know, and now that I've – and, folks, I've known this for about – I've known Kevin for a couple of years, and I've known it for that length of time. And you just don't notice it, but it's there when you look at the World War II films, black and white, and et cetera, and there he's got the binoculars, but right below it is the camera.
Yep.
That's right, folks. He could have had a platoon of photographers, of writers, of filmmakers. He didn't. He wanted it to be before his eyes. How can they get that book, Kevin?
Amazon.com.
Well, that's good. And once again, what's the title?
Patton Photographs. It's self-described.
Just like that. Patton.
There you go.
With author Kevin Hemel, H-Y-M-E-L.
That's me.
That's it. And let's go back to John. John, all right, besides September Hope, I'm looking at a whole list here, folks, John McManus, but one of them, The Dead and Those About to Die, D-Day, The Big Red One on Omaha Beach. Tell us about that, John.
Yeah, that book just came out last year in time for the 70th anniversary, and it covers the experiences of the 1st Infantry Division, which, of course, was one of the major assault components at Omaha Beach. It covers their experiences just on D-Day and their segment of Omaha Beach, which is about 60% of the beach, I would say. And it's just a remarkable story of people in a dire circumstance, leadership under fire, people improvising and, you know, to pull off what is, I think, we'd all agree, one of the most important American military victories in the history of our country. So the book really gives you a kind of a nice personal look at what this battle was like for some of the key players and people who are not all that well known. And I think it kind of, my feeling was that the Omaha Beach was really well known. It wasn't all that well understood. And I hope that the book adds something to our overall understanding of the Battle of Omaha Beach and why it turns out the way it does.
Okay, folks, that's The Dead and Those About to Die, D-Day, the Big Red One on Omaha Beach. Kindle edition. Oh, okay, I shouldn't read that part. That's right. And John C.
Buy the book.
I know. Buy the book. Well, folks, do your shopping on Veterans Radio. Come on. We do all the screening. We actually get the folks that write it, do the research on this. I've got another one here that was talking about concentration camps. Before their very eyes, the American soldiers liberate concentration camps in Germany, 1945. Tell us about that, John.
Yeah, that's a new book I have coming out on October 22nd. It's called Hell Before Their Very Eyes, American Soldiers Liberate Concentration Camps in Germany, April 1945. And basically what I do is I look at the liberation of three camps, Ohrdruf, Buchenwald, and Dachau, as sort of indicative of the larger American experience. Because, though we know the Holocaust fairly well, believe it or not, the American liberation or witnessing experience has not been all that well covered by historians. And though I don't consider myself to be an historian of the Holocaust, I am an American military historian, a soldier's historian, and I thought that was one small aspect of it that I could contribute to. So, again, the book will be out on October the 22nd.
Now,
John, you need to write more books. You know that?
I know. I need to get to work.
Now, something I wanted to ask, and I'll ask this of John, when these camps were liberated, and there were lots of them, folks, that there just wasn't the four or five that we hear about. There were lots of them. Did the on occasion, and I don't think it was anecdotal, did the Americans shoot the guards?
Well, there was one major instance, and really only this, at Dachau, that there were reprisals against some of the guards who were captured there. And I go into this in great detail in the book and examine it from every source that I'm aware of that exists. And what the irony of the whole thing and what happens there, those guards who are executed were really not the actual full-time Dachau guards. They were people who had sort of haphazardly come in there to hold the camp for a day or two before the liberation. And yet the American soldiers were so angry, so upset, as you can imagine, from what they saw, which was just terrible. And, of course, I go into that in great detail, too, about what this was like, that I think in this instance, because of leadership failure, they end up getting angry and executing some of the guards.
Well, I don't think that would be leadership failure on my part.
I go into great detail.
I know.
At that point, you are sort of ceding the morality of the Allied cause if you're going to take immediate reprisals. And the post-war, war crimes, trials, and all this kind of thing. And Dachau was the only real instance in which this happened. Because I contrast it with Buchenwald, in which the soldiers were every bit as upset. And you can understand why, of course, again, as well. But it's just a tragic story all the way around, but I think a really important one.
Kevin, you're working on a book. We've got 2 minutes. Tell us about it.
It's called Patton's War, and it's just covering General Patton from the moment he steps on those beaches in North Africa to the end of the war. I've found a lot of very interesting stories about the general through primary research, so hopefully I can bring something new to the table on General Patton.
Guys, we have 1 minute. By the way, I do, in case you all want to Google this, John McManus, John C. McManus, McManus, John C. McManus, McManus, and Kevin, Kevin, Hemel, Hymel. Real quick, we got a minute, John. You got one of the last words. Go ahead.
Well, one last word I had is just it's a plug for my friend Kevin Hemel. I've worked with for years. There's nobody who understands General Patton, his legacy, his importance. There's no scholar today that I'm aware of who knows more about that. So I'd highly recommend anything he does. In terms of, Market Gardner, if you're interested in exploring more about that, I wrote a book called September Hope that explores the American experience in the battle, really from the soldier's perspective, and a lot about General Gavin, who I think is a fascinating person. So I encourage you to check that out.
Kevin?
John, you're the man.
Kevin, you got 30 seconds.
I will return the same favor and say, John, you to me are probably the American scholar when it comes to the American Army in the European theater. My only wish is that you would do something about the American Army in the Pacific theater, but I know that you're working on a 2-volume history as we speak, and I can't wait to read it. I enjoy everything that you write. And I'm just going to add that, you know, here we are in the month of September. I've been hearing a lot about a lot of ceremonies for Market Garden and the great feelings that the Dutch have for Americans. So I'm just going to conclude by saying, go Redskins.
Yeah. And I want to thank both of our authors for again being on our program. Remember to go out there and buy their books. And thank you, Kevin. Thank you, John.
All right, Bob. Great talking to you.
Next week, Dale Thronberry. Remember, we're going to be talking about PTS. That's right. Drop the D. Remember, drop the D. Don't say it anymore. It's going to take you a little bit, but drop the D. PTS. Dale will be talking about that. You're going to want to tune in if you know anybody, neighbor, friend, relative, what. Until that time, this is Bob Gould signing off, and you are dismissed.